Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for July 2018. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by my good friend, Tim Nelson. Welcome back to the show, Tim. It's great to be with you again.
Good to be with you too, John. I think this is going to be a weird podcast.
Why is that?
Because I am kind of sick.
Oh no!
And I'm kind of drippy right now. It's kind of sick.
What's our weather report?
Oh, it's hot.
It's hot and muggy all the time.
It's hot. It's muggy. We had a day of like beautiful weather, but we give the weather report each time. It's not timely by any means. By the time you get this, it will mean nothing.
It means nothing. That's the whole point. We gave a tornado warning last time, and I think some people heard it a little too late.
It was scary for them. Well, probably not scary. They didn't hear the warning, but it's going to be a little fast and loose tonight because I am sick.
Yeah.
And I'm not making any sense to myself.
Uh-huh. This is going to be the loopy one. People will refer back to it from years from now and be like, that was the one where Tim was like, I don't know.
What happened?
Exactly. Yeah.
What drugs was he on?
Yep.
Yes, I understand.
I think it's going to be great.
So John was excited about that, actually.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Perfect. I've been waiting for this.
People have been waiting for us to put our hair down, finally.
Okay, so let's let our hair down. Yep. We have basically more beard hair than anything else here.
Yeah, we do.
There's a lot of beards flying around. The mics are constantly getting beard hairs on them. It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
Drippy beard hairs.
So there you go. We'll go ahead and put a trigger warning up front. We don't know what we're going to say. It's just it's that kind of a night.
It's that kind of night, but we are faithful. It's just like anything that's worth doing. We showed up.
Yep.
Sick.
Yes.
To my own house, actually.
Yeah.
But I'm sick. I don't feel good. I'm really whiny about that generally, and I'm going to do that tonight. Probably I'll talk about it some more.
Beautiful.
And John, see, he could get sick.
Yeah, I could.
I'm committed
from this conversation, he's probably going to get sick.
Yeah. You can't get sick, so don't worry. You can listen. I don't think they can they?
No, they can't. I don't think it's transmitted through the speakers, no.
I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
I'm not a scientist. In fact, I haven't taken very much science.
We're already off the rails. This is fantastic.
I'm not a scientist, but I don't think people can get sick. But you could, but you're that committed. See, I'm not even as committed as you are.
I'm in the sick zone, and I'm loving every minute of it.
Yeah.
So, Tim, what have you been watching, man? What's been on your radar? Have you been too sick to watch anything? Anything new come across your way?
What have I been watching?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot.
All right.
I've been really busy.
Yeah.
And so what have I been watching lately? I watched this film, and then I watched another film that has to do with this film.
Okay. Watching a film on Netflix related to it?
Yeah. So not a ton lately. It's been, and then my kids have been home a lot because it's summertime.
Yes.
So I watched Napoleon Dynamite most recently.
Oh my gosh. I haven't seen that since college. How was the rewatch?
It's great.
It's a good movie, right?
Yeah.
That's what I remember. Yeah. But there's kind of a backlash in recent, like people are like, back when we used to like Napoleon Dynamite, like people kind of have that negative view of it in retrospect, but it still stands up.
It's just fun.
Yeah, it's a fun movie.
It's a fun movie. You can just imagine some guys in their 20s making this weird movie.
Yes.
And they did it, and it's just lots of fun.
Yeah. Well, I want to give a shout out to a show that you can stream on Netflix, Better Call Saul. Probably not a new show to anyone's ears.
More TV.
I always do. You know me.
Okay, I love the TV show that you're talking about.
Do you watch it? I'm not talking about Breaking Bad. I'm talking about Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Okay. You've been watching it.
I actually like it. We reviewed a film he was in.
Yeah.
We
did Bob Odenkirk.
But yeah.
Yeah. Great actor.
He is.
But the real star of that show to me is Vince Gilligan. He's the executive producer, because I just feel like going from Breaking Bad, which is legitimately one of the best shows ever, in my opinion, probably that and The Wire are my two favorite shows of all time, and going from that with all the expectation and Emmy wins and everything, and doing something that's really marches to a totally different beat, goes in a different direction, and still managing to make something that's great. Vince Gilligan, man. I'm going to follow that guy everywhere. I love it.
I think there's something about Odenkirk's character.
Mm-hmm.
He's lowbrow and he's pragmatic. He's quintessentially he's American in some ways.
Interesting.
And he's going to make it happen no matter what. And his brother is not that way.
Yes. The dynamic with his brother is the linchpin of that show. It's beautiful.
Yeah. So I like that film. My wife's an attorney.
Okay.
Like that. Well, she doesn't practice, but she's barred and all that.
Mm-hmm,
and she likes it too. She loves the dynamics of it. It gives you a real sense of like what actual firms would treat how they would treat somebody like
yes like Jimmy.
Yeah it was just really it's interesting stuff.
It's great. So both of us recommend that. It's on Netflix. You can watch it now. And you know what I heard is that I read in an interview that they're going to try to bring back like Walt White and Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad. They're going to work them in, and not as like a cameo. They said they specifically don't want it to just be like, oh, they just walk by the shot and you're like, oh, that was them. Like, they want to actually try to work them in somehow into a prequel.
Is it going to be like the Star Wars movie where they're like a CGI? Because
no,
Jesse Pinkman's
they're still
like
alive.
My age now, but he started that.
right.
Wow, we're not even talking about cinema again.
I know. I love it. This is the TV spot. I love it. I'm going to talk about a TV show every single time.
I realize it's your website. It's your podcast.
That's right.
I realize that.
Yeah.
But I also am like, man, I didn't agree to this.
I love how it makes you feel.
It gets my blood boiling.
Every week, I'm going to talk about TV, and Tim's going to complain, and that is the segment of the show, which is probably my favorite part. So that's what's going to happen.
I'm going to complain every time. Yeah, I am.
All right, Tim. So we're going to take a little detour here. At the heart of the summer, you and I, to my knowledge, have never reviewed a documentary.
I don't think so either. I was thinking about this today.
Yeah. This is our first one. And that's exciting to me. And we're going to take a look at one today. But it's not just any documentary. This is a special film that people have been talking about for weeks. And I, personally, was blown away when I saw it because I think it's like a movie we really need right now. So the movie is Won't You Be My Neighbor? That is our subject for today, the documentary about Fred Rogers. So, Tim, when did you see this movie?
Last week. I don't remember. I'm a little bit drippy.
Did you see it with your wife? Because I know that she really wanted to see it.
No.
Okay. So you went alone.
Child care issues.
Absolutely.
I just had to go.
I totally agree.
I'm sick, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
I don't feel good.
I was going to go with a friend, and then he canceled, and I'm actually really glad he did, because I teared up a lot during this movie, and it could have been kind of awkward sitting next to him. This movie really moved me deeply, and I was glad to be alone in my personal space as I choked through some tears. So,
like when you watch Beaches with me?
Beaches. Bette Midler, man.
Do you ever know that you're my hero? Is that from that movie?
I don't remember.
You ever know? Oh, yeah.
I watched that with my mom when I was like eight, maybe. I don't know.
I'm sick.
Yeah. This is a special movie. That's the point. And before we dive in, I just want to take a moment to talk about documentaries, since we've never actually talked about them on this podcast. So I remember when I originally brought up this idea of seeing this movie during the Infinity War podcast, you were like, no, like we shouldn't do that because documentaries are so hard to review. And they are, in a way, because our show typically, you know, we dismantle acting and writing and all of that and all the technical craft of film. But with documentaries, all of that talent, which is still required, is really underneath the surface. So, Tim, what are your thoughts on documentaries as a whole? And have there been any that have really stood out to you over the years as special?
So one of the things about documentaries that I began to notice, I've been watching a bunch of Errol Morris films. So he's done a bunch of stuff, including a bunch of weird Miller High Life ads. That's actually the first thing I actually saw of his.
Nice.
But probably most known for the Thin Blue Line. Mm-hmm. There used to be something where some filmmaker in the 70s, 60s or 70s could go somewhere that you couldn't go, right? Like you were like, oh, I'm stuck in my job here and I don't want to make fun of Paducah again. I'll get in a lot of trouble. I got in trouble already
last
for
time.
That.
Yeah.
I was talking trash about Paducah, Kentucky, and it turns out Paducah does have an independent theater.
Oh my gosh.
But they weren't playing the movie we were talking about.
All right.
Check out the podcast. But I got in trouble from friends that are fans of Paducah, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So Paducah is sophisticated. Paducah is a land of enchantment. Oh, wait, that's a different thing. That might be Minnesota. But in any case, Paducah, Kentucky.
Yep.
Great place to visit.
Great place.
Great place to live. Anyway, so I was going to say about I started watching all these Errol Morris films.
Yeah.
And it seems like Errol Morris and there's some other folks who, the Grey Gardens, guys that made Grey Gardens, which I don't know if you're familiar with that film or not. It's like you go and you get access to somebody that's never been highlighted, or a community that's never been highlighted, or something strange, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get access to that, and then you just kind of let that go. And then your editing kind of creates an editorial feel to the documentary. It creates tone.
Yeah.
And I think it's harder and harder to do that because people have more and more connection. So like Errol Morris did one on pet cemeteries. So if I wanted to like, you know, in the 70s, if I wanted to know about pet cemeteries, I'd have to like go look at microfiche like on the somewhere in some big library somewhere. Right.
Yeah.
And everything would be dated. Now I can like put pet cemeteries in the, and I could find like, you know, however many there are and learn everything about them and hit, you know, hit their about button and I know everything.
So you're saying documentaries might be less relevant in the age of Google.
I think they're harder to, I think it's harder to make a documentary that doesn't feel like a Wikipedia entry where it's like they were born here or behind the music. I think it's harder to do that. The document, like before, it was like, can we find these kind of Southern Gothic or Gothic characters that seem unreal, who live bizarre lives, who will make us think in a different way or who will inform our worldview. So like Morris does that. I forgot the name of the name of the brothers who did Grey Gardens it's a team, but they were capable of doing that. Now I feel like every rock has been, unturned. Every corner has been looked at. And we're so voyeuristic now. It's like you can't really uncover those characters. And those characters have knowledge of us, too.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't trust people. So you can't, like, go into a closed community and, like, be trusted or build trust because they'll figure out who you are. They'll, like, you know, find you online and be like, hey, this guy's going to make a mockery of us.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's
anyway.
True, though. I know what you're saying. That is kind of the power of documentaries is stumbling upon this novel person or idea. Like one of my favorite documentaries is from 2005. It's Grizzly Man. Did you ever see that one? It's this guy who like just hung out with bears in Alaska like by himself, and he would just film himself just hugging bears and hanging out with them, and then he eventually got eaten by bears in his tent. And it's just like so fascinating. That's Werner Herzog did that one. And
example.
And so it's basically like, I mean, you can read a Wikipedia page about him, but like watching his own movies for an hour and a half, like it's just this incredible, you know, man and nature and this character study of this guy walking a line between passion and insanity. It's just beautiful. So, I mean, there's something powerful about that. And then there's other kinds of documentaries that really make you activated. I remember I watched Bully a couple of years ago, which is about bullying, and I was so riveted. Riveted is even the right word. I was so angry at this modern day problem of bullying that I was just, by the end of it, I was pacing around my house, and I actually literally called the local superintendent to my school system that night. Like, I didn't call him. I emailed him. And I was like, I'm local. I just saw this movie. We've got to stop bullying. Like, what can I do? Like, that's the power of documentaries, right? It can get you up off the couch and like change you. So they can be very powerful tools.
That's true. I think of like a Michael Moore documentary.
Michael Moore, yeah. And I know everyone thinks like politics, you know, but like if you put the politics aside, he is a very skilled documentary filmmaker.
So I think people tend to think of Activate when they think of documentaries, or they think of like, all right, we're going to watch the lions and the hyenas have a war. It's going to take 2 hours and I'm going to fall asleep to this hyena war.
It's a Richard Attenborough's narration. Yeah.
The lion, you know, the female lion hunts while the male lion lays in the grass. This arrangement has been the same for thousands of years. Like that kind beautiful. Of stuff, right?
Yeah.
They fight the hyenas and the lions get a blow. You know, they get one and then the hyenas get one. And then it's like, oh, this is such a beautiful movie.
You know, March of the Penguins.
Some meerkats here and there. Right. So those are documentaries too. So it's like this big...
Yeah, it's a big tent.
Thing. Or like food documentaries. It's like everybody's watching these chef documentaries. Ooh, I want to know what's happening behind the scenes. And how do these chefs think and artists think? So I think you get these profiles. They function really well, but there's so many categories.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say, but I think I like the ones that are more like Flannery O'Connor novels come to life. Mm-hmm. Like that's the stuff I like. And those are, I think, harder and harder to make.
And the skill, like I was saying earlier, is so hidden underneath the surface because there is a vast difference between a good and bad documentary. Like I think all of us have seen a bad documentary in our lifetime. I mean, if in school, if nothing else, right? Or you're just like
little
dry
Jimmy
interviews.
Learns about intercourse.
That's sex ed.
Hey, but that was a documentary.
Oh my
format,
gosh, that's
I
right. Dad, something's wrong
all
with
right,
the
all
sheets.
Right. Okay, all right.
Tom is 14. Compared to his 9-year-old brother, he looks almost like a man. But he isn't. Tom is an adolescent, still growing and developing. He's going to shoot a good many more baskets before he's full grown.
Did I mention I'm sick? Yes, we went there just now. We are not going to inform your children about the birds, the bees.
Yeah, that's another podcast. It's different. There's one that teaches all about
that. We're not qualified
that.
To be honest with you.
No, absolutely not.
I'm not. I don't know about you.
I'm still learning myself. Okay. I'm sick. No, I can't use that.
You don't have any. You may be sick later. But
anyway, all of that to say that it takes great skill to string together the right editing, the right pacing, the right music. I mean, there really is. There's a talent to it. And it's so, because there's the illusion of you're just watching real life, that you kind of lose the fact of how much skill is going into the production. Whereas the different than a fictional, you know, narrative film, it's like, oh, okay, this is stylized, etc. Yeah.
So I think like getting out of the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like really critical. So like sometimes, or getting in the way. So like Michael Moore is really good about getting in the way. Morris is good about getting out of the way and letting people say their own weird damning things.
Yeah.
So like, I love this one. I can't remember the name of the documentary. You can look it up on IMDb or whatever, but he has one. I don't know if I talked about this one last time or not, but
I think so.
It's so Errol Morris found out like in this newspaper article, this is like his second film or third film, that there was this whole community in Florida that was cutting their toes off so they could get this ability.
What?
Yeah. So you're like, automatically the dude's like, I got to get down there and get a camera.
Yeah.
So he gets down there and people figure out that he's making this film and he's doing it about, you know, them cutting their toes off because it actually was happening.
Holy cow.
And they were about to like, you know, turn on him. So he's like, well, I better change this a little bit. So he stops and he follows all these people and what they're passionate about in that same community. And one dude's like really passionate about animals. And like another person is like super passionate about hunting. And so he just, one's a cop. Hmm. And it's, he almost like comes off like the cop in Magnolia. Like just kind of, I don't know, how to, like a little, like aloof, high strung and rule bound. But he's able to get out of the way enough. I know I'm obsessed with Errol Morris. He's able to get out of the way enough to like let them tell their own bizarre stories.
Yes.
And I think there's something to that. So it's like get out of the way. Get in the way. So disrupt or allow enough room for people to let this stuff come out.
That's good, man. So I had not heard of the director of Won't You Be My Neighbor. His name is Morgan Neville.
Yeah.
Does that name ring a bell to you?
Only because I watched the other film.
Okay.
But it didn't like initially, I was like, I don't know this guy.
You watched his other movie. What was it called? Do you remember?
It was Best of Enemies.
Best of Enemies. That was on his list of like, yeah. And he also made something called 20 Feet from Stardom. So how was Best of Enemies?
Excellent.
What was it about?
It was about, so in 1968, ABC News was the third out of the three networks. Mm-hmm. The joke was if there was a fourth network, they would have been the fourth because they had limited budget. And they were up against like Walter Cronkite and some other news teams that were like really fantastic. In any case, they're trying to cover the Republican and the Democratic National Convention. Uh-huh. And so they're like, well, what can we do that's different? And so they invite these two commentators. One is William F. Buckley Jr., which if you've been around, you might know that name. Incredibly conservative, kind of like the great conservative debater of that era.
Okay.
And then the other one is Gore Vidal, which you may have heard of from, he was a novelist, mm-hmm. but he would be more liberal.
Okay.
And so the idea of this movie was he's looking at the beginning of television when we went from news as something that's a centrist thing that's helping us understand the world to where it became punditry. And so he sees this moment of the 68 convention and these two individuals as being the very beginning of what we have now, which is arguments. Hmm. All the time.
Interesting.
So it goes into that, and it's a lot of archival footage. Yeah.
So it's a good documentary.
It's a great documentary, and their hate for one another is so pure. It's
oh,
like,
no.
I mean, they just dig into each other. And then, so anyway, he's looking at that, and then what is acceptable to do culturally has totally changed.
Hmm.
And you'd think it would be one way, but it's actually less, they're actually less acceptable now than they would have been back then. You would think the other way around.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So well, there you go. Yeah. Morgan Neville. And that's on Netflix. Do you remember?
Yeah, it's on Netflix.
Okay, so if you're...
I looked it up pretty quick.
So if you've seen Won't You Be My Neighbor and you want to check out more from Morgan Neville, that is Best of Enemies. Buckley versus Vidal is the subtitle of that. So there you go. I didn't see anything else that he's done, and I didn't know his name going into this. So all I have is this latest project. And that, of course, is Won't You Be My Neighbor, this movie about Fred Rogers. So, Tim, in the hidden art of documentary filmmaking that we just talked about, what are your thoughts of Morgan Neville and how he constructs this movie about Mr. Rogers from a artistic craftsmanship point of view? What do you think he brings to the table?
So I've seen another kind of movie about Rogers before, and it was more like somebody probably my age that rediscovers Mr. Rogers as an adult. And I don't remember the name of it, but it's not so great. What I think he brings to it is he takes a figure that we all think we know already, mm-hmm. and he actually helps us get to know that figure. Mm-hmm. I also think that I think a lot of good documentary filmmaking, if you're doing like a biopic kind of a documentary, involves contradictions, so that you want to point out contradictions in the person, contradictions in the zeitgeist, contradictions in all those things. Because I think it makes it interesting. It creates tension.
Yeah.
And so he's like, Mr. Rogers is the most beloved Republican. Right, and everyone's like, what?
Lifelong Republican. Everyone's wow. like, wow.
Yeah, so he's the most beloved Republican since Lincoln or something. But the idea is that he had all these values. He's anti-war. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't fit in like what you might think. Mm-hmm. And so I thought he did a good job as far as you're profiling somebody. And he did a good job, and he like kind of strings you along. You got to do that.
Yes.
So you can't just be, he's a great guy and he's so nice.
Right. The pacing and the flow is incredible. Like really, you're for 90 minutes, you are fascinated at every turn that he takes.
He creates character development by using the puppets.
Yeah.
So he talks about how Rogers changes over the years, mm-hmm. and he uses the puppets as the way to discuss that. He talks about he gets into the psychology of him. Which I think you need that element because otherwise, because I think that's what we're always questioning about Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
You're like, oh, what's wrong with this guy? You're all, dude, you need to like go on a vacation or something, you know? He just seems a little high strung.
He was a saint, Tim. He was a saint.
So, which is the critique of this film.
Yeah.
From some of the critics. This is hagiographic. So it's like basically we've taken a human being and turned them into a saint. So it's like he's no longer allowed to be human.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Well, we'll get to that. But let's start off with Mr. Rogers as a minister, because I didn't know anything about that.
Like,
all I knew going into this movie was Mr. Rogers was a nice old guy. There were like three times I can remember after school laying on the carpet watching this guy, right? That's it. That's all I knew. So I didn't know anything about the deeper layers that made him up. So he actually went to seminary.
Yep.
He was a legitimate minister. And this show was like his church. Like he preached sermons to these kids every week without preaching sermons, right? And that was fascinating to me. How much did you know going into it?
So I knew that stuff because I grew up in the same denomination that he was ordained in.
Oh, interesting. What was that?
Presbyterian Church.
Presbyterian, okay.
And it might have changed. There's probably a change in the name of it during the time that he was ordained. So mm-hmm. at this point, it would be like PCUSA. So he's ordained in that. He goes in. Yeah, I just am. It was very impressive. Like one of the things his wife said in the film was, this is a revolutionary thing to ordain someone to do to minister to children through television.
Yeah. That was literally his ministry. Like, right.
So, I mean, that's pretty radical. Mm-hmm. And then the church would have room for that.
Yep.
And
would they nowadays, right?
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I was thinking about how much is that a reflection of kind of the neo-Orthodox views of that time.
Mm.
So it's like, no, we must engage culture, which you would have like in those circles, you would have that.
Mm-hmm.
So the debate isn't, it would be more like, well, we've got to engage culture. Television is a primary conduit of culture, mm-hmm. culture creating even. And so we either do nothing or we do something.
Yep.
And so Rogers does something, and it looks like nothing else.
Right. And the way he engaged culture is so important. You know, Emily Dickinson said, tell the truth, but tell it slant, right? That's what he did. And that we have lost. I don't know if we have. I mean, he is an example that Christian filmmakers really need to look to, because I just saw a poster for God's Not Dead 3, and that is not happening for me, man.
So I actually watched Mr. Rogers while he was still on the, like, it wasn't reruns.
Yeah.
When I was a little kid. And his stuff, I couldn't stand his stuff, to be honest.
Really? You didn't like the show? Okay.
No, because it was just like the pacing was, and you know, I'm an ADD kid. Mm-hmm. The pacing was slow. It seemed canned to me. I didn't, like the characters, the land of make-believe, those characters like drove me crazy. I'm like, dude, that's the worst voice I've ever heard. It was just a very...
Oh, no.
I get enough like low production value in church when I was a kid that like I was like, we're going to watch G.I. Joe. Yeah. The screenwriter went to Harvard. Yeah. But
so you were not a fan of the show.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, no. And he was so slow and deliberate.
But that's what made it revolutionary, right? He broke all the rules that any TV producer would say, this is how you make a good show. He's an old guy and he does puppets, but... Millions of kids, Tim, did not share your opinion about the show.
I know,
and
they loved him.
Raptured. Yeah.
I know. They're probably nice people, these kids.
Yep. They're wonderful, fully functioning adults.
So give me some He-Man, you know? Some muscle-bound action figure that's fighting everyone.
That's
what
right.
He wouldn't be into, I'm sure. Anyway.
But he preached this message without using God and faith. It was basically, the central message was, that you are loved and you don't have to do anything to earn that love. And that's the core message of the gospel, right? And I thought it was interesting how that this is kind of turned into a modern criticism of that Mr. Rogers basically is responsible for our entitled millennial generation, because he told an entire generation of kids that they were loved and special before they did anything to earn it. And that does not fit well with...
So that messaging was so weird to me, because I don't think that's millennials, because I mean, he dies in 2003.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, probably not. You're right.
And no, but I don't think you're misidentifying. I think the film misidentifies.
Okay.
It's not really millennials. It's like Gen X that Mr. Rogers, I mean, what is it in the, so it's like mid-60s.
The heydays were the 60s, right? Yeah.
It's like mid-60s to, and then you get some stuff in the 80s, but he starts, you know, rerunning everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's the group that you're really talking to. It's really the Gen X, and I don't think that characteristic really plays out.
That's true. I mean, like I said, I watched Mr. Rogers a couple times, but more my generation was Nickelodeon, you know, back when Salute Your Shorts, Hey right. Dude, Rugrats, Doug, like that was back in the heyday, right? Of Nickelodeon. There used to be this thing called the Big Orange Couch on Saturday night. Snick. Yeah, Snick. And there are people out there that know exactly what I'm talking about. Tim is not one of those people. And
I could know what you're talking about. I have a little sister who's
there you go.
20... how old is she? 92? That would make her 26. Almost.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, and maybe this is just something that everyone feels, but that programming was so much better back then. Like there was more thought put into a story and it was slower, and it actually, you know, everything today, the stuff my kids are watching, like
kids these days.
PJ Masks, I know, right? And literally kids these days, just the stuff that I feel like it's coming at everything so fast. And then Mr. Rogers was like even dialed down below like the Nickelodeon stuff. So it's just a marvel that it was so successful when it was. And I don't know if it would work today. Like, I'll be the first to admit my kids would take one look at Mr. Rogers and be like, that is boring. And that's sad.
So when you say would it work, the question is like, is it, as far as public television, I mean, this is like a highly subsidized thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this can get into the debate of it, but it doesn't work in a sense of like as far as capitalism goes, really. Uh-huh. Right. So like, if you want to just like, hey, I'm going to pitch a show, it's horrible. And it won't sell any toys. Like, nobody's going to be interested in that, right? I mean, maybe public television.
You could buy the puppets.
Yeah. It's, okay. You know, I guess you figured it out, a marketing strategy. Anyway, but like, to me, it's like this show is I see it as barely working back then.
You're like, it didn't work. That's the whole point, John.
Kind of, yeah. I mean...
Well, also, I mean, another thing to think about is that our culture is so changed to the point where everything, all media is so segmented now, right? Like that was still back in a time where everyone gathered around a television. We were watching things as a community, whereas now it's like everything now, you know, like Arcade Fire's new album where we want to pay one thing and we want to get it all, right? And so everyone has their own niche. So you have to do so much more to stand out nowadays than you did when there were four channels. So yeah.
I like that he's very mystical. Like his approach. Mm-hmm. So in the film, and it shows that he's into the central idea of the scriptures, right? So like that Yes. You are loved, and then not only that you're loved, because I think that that's like, we talk about that a lot as Jesus followers. Oh, you're loved. God loves you. You know,
very important message.
I think you're a butthole, but God loves you, yeah. Right?
Right.
But I think that there's this other message, which is that you are also capable of love.
Interesting. And he mentions that, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the central things we need to teach kids, that they're capable of loving. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about that because like that's one of our deepest needs. I think about the film Magnolia.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I know. I mentioned it twice. I don't know why it's on my mind now. I didn't have any reason, but I know there's that Amy Mann song.
Yeah.
And it talks to, you know, so basically like, am I going to be able to love anybody? Can you know, the Save Me song or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's not so much that you can't be loved by someone, but that you're incapable of loving others. And I think Rogers gives the idea, like gives us these kids this idea and us too, that no, we're not only loved by God and that we're special, right?
Yeah.
But that also that we have love to give, which is like the idea of this neighbor idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's pretty cool.
Magnolia Sing Along. To Save Me. Well, that's Paul Thomas Anderson, man. That's just so genius. Just this Tom Cruise singing in his car, everyone singing along. Like how to have the guts to do that.
Yeah.
Save me.
I love it, man.
It's great.
You sound good. Let's record right now. I got a ukulele upstairs.
That's right.
I don't know if that's a proper instrument.
But can you save me? Come on. Suspect they could never love anyone.
So it was a revolutionary show. I mean, I know what you're saying about the fact that, yes, the production values and everything, but think about the topics they discussed. This blew my mind because I had no idea how much he was just taking on what was happening in culture, right? Like divorce, but like even current events like Bobby Kennedy's assassination and the Challenger disaster. What other kid's show is going to touch that with a 10-foot pole? But he felt responsible for the kids that were watching. Like they're stuff is being talked about all around them and no one's willing to talk to them. And he was the voice. I mean, I think that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know if you would find someone with the guts to do that nowadays.
There is something about like, if your show is like not, if you don't have like some kind of corporate sponsor that's breathing down your neck, mm-hmm. you can actually do what you want.
Right.
And I think that you see this because like there's nothing like marketable about the show really. And so he's able to, you know, he's the public television model and he's able to connect with kids and not try to sell them something or try to move them to something that they, without their consent,
yes.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
And I feel like almost everything, the media that we consume now is basically we're being tricked all the time. You know, you talk about, oh, I clicked on the clickbait. You know what
mm-hmm,
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that we're constantly at war with media. Like, oh, am I being tricked? Am I being tricked? I know I think that like 20 times a day. Am I being manipulated? Am I being manipulated? Am I being manipulated?
We are. Yeah.
And I think what stands out, why this movie stands out now even more so than like if they did this movie 10 years ago,
uh-huh.
is that's what media is to us is how am I being tricked? Even like when you talk about Netflix, you're like, why is the Netflix originals buttons so much bigger than name the movie The Godfather?
Yeah.
It doesn't really make any sense. Why is this in the same category? Critically acclaimed by what critic? You know, it's like those are the questions we have. And so I think like in an era where we're constantly being manipulated, tricked, this stands out as being like, oh, no, And it seems unsophisticated. It seems, yeah, like just otherworldly.
He's not tricking kids.
He's not tricking anybody. And mm-hmm. I think we're so used to that, that it just really, the contrast between our culture and the media and the contrast between that and then what he originally set out to do is just very clear.
I was at my friend's house the other day, and he was mentioning to me that he's going to get rid of his TV, and he's going to put a projector in the back. And he was talking about this freestanding projector that he was going to get. Later that night, I am on Amazon or whatever, and I get these freaking ads for a projector, just like what he was talking about. And I didn't type this into my phone. I didn't type it into a search bar. Literally, like, my iPhone is listening to me,
yep.
And I think that's really creepy.
Yeah, so we have like a smart TV, and we get ads for stuff that I'd never seen ads for as soon as we search for them.
Oh my
God. So I was looking at like sunglasses the other day, and all of a sudden, like a sunglasses commercial. Have you ever even seen a sunglasses commercial
no,
on TV?
I
no,
haven't.
Nobody has. Because that's not real. It's somebody that is marketing to me because I put something in a search engine.
Yeah.
It's See, even on Bible websites.
That's the age of being tricked. Mr. Rogers wouldn't have any of it, Tim. So,
he's so heavenly minded, he might be no earthly good.
Oh, snap. But one thing that I think we can both agree on, even if we can't agree that he was a saint, is that he had a way with kids. This guy could walk into a room and sit down with kids and just let them be and totally just listen without an agenda. I don't have that. I'm a father of three, and I just don't have it, man. And I left the theater literally vowing to be a better father because I was just so impressed with the way he interacted with kids.
Yeah, I walked out and I'm like, man, I'll never be that kid. I was like,
see?
Oh, I think the message, and it might be my psychology, right?
Yeah.
My message was supposed to be you're special and you're loved and you're capable of love. And I'm like, man, I could never do that.
It's awesome.
I'm like, yeah, I think I would probably go, you're going to clean up your room right now.
Yeah.
And like, he's more like, how are you?
Is that your impression?
Or I don't know. I don't have an impression. He's just like very
Tiger.
Calm. He just like look at you and be like, how's your day going? Or whatever he
says.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I don't talk to my kids with puppets. I tried it actually. This is part of being sick right here.
Yeah.
I did talk to my daughter with a Barbie doll this morning to
oh
see
my
if
gosh.
That worked. And it does.
It does.
How are you?
Because you
she's
don't.
Like, I'm
yeah.
okay.
It's not like Mr. Rogers tried to disguise it with like you know like they could put it together, but they chose to separate the two. Like this, you know.
Maybe we should podcast with puppets.
That's what I'm saying.
Hi, John.
It's a little hard because you know the visual element.
I need to work on my voices.
But I'm totally with you. Like just
puppet podcast. That's like straight out of the sickness speaking.
It's one of those crazy
speaking,
ideas that will not sound good tomorrow morning.
The thing about podcasting with puppets
yeah.
is where do you put the mics?
That is the problem.
You might need another set of mics
yeah.
for it to be believable to everyone.
Also, they can't see the puppets. You know, I could tell everyone that I have a puppet right now. They don't know.
Well, the puppets have a slightly different voice than we do.
Well, I could just make a different voice. You don't need the puppets. That's the whole point. The podcast is not the ideal format for a puppet show.
John, you're killing this before it starts.
Anyway,
culture of innovation here.
But when I sit down with my kids, I find myself wanting to control too much. You know, like if they start going, if my 5-year-old starts bouncing off the walls, I want to, you know, step in there and be like, blah, 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 blah. But Mr. Rogers didn't do that. He just had a way of letting kids be. It's how I imagine Jesus was with kids. You know, I'd be like the Pharisee, be like, dude. Quiet. He's got stuff to teach.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be a better father after that movie. I was literally on the walk to my car and I think I failed the next day, but every day is a chance to start over.
And the guy's not perfect.
Okay.
Then the film alludes to that. I think he's
where does it allude to it? Because I saw his own kid say that he was like a second Christ. Okay. That's his own kid
he's
talking.
He's referring to people's.
You think so?
Yeah. He's referring to people's like what they think of his dad.
So what's the dark side of Mr.
Hard,
Rogers?
He said it was hard growing up with like the second Christ as your dad.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Or something along those lines. So I think what he, and then he talked about if he wanted to say something adult, he would like change his voice to do it. And he would say
at the table. Yeah.
And then the other thing that was alluded to was I think Rogers actually said this in an interview, was that they weren't allowed to express anger as kids. And so yeah, I don't see him expressing anger very much as an adult either.
Right.
Now, I have, I think that we have an anger issue as a culture, which is that we, it's not that we don't, I think it's that we use anger as like a coverall for every emotion, American men. And we tend to just get pissed about stuff all the time. And I, you know, I got my own stuff. So this is like, I'm projecting a little bit here. But what I would say is like, we tend to kind of use anger constantly. So even if you look at, like, this goes into old films, right? So like the cowboy idea.
Yeah.
So we want we want our heroes to look like cowboys who go in and clean up the town, which is a totally like, I have power. It might be hidden. I have power and I'm going to clean up the town, which is like, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then Die Hard is like the modern day cowboy, right? And then it just continues. Yeah.
And so I think I think that's a really lousy model of masculinity.
Right.
And what we're given instead, I think that was really challenging. So this gets into like, what is, you know, because people are talking, oh, you must be gay. And he's like, no, he's not gay.
Mm-hmm.
This is a different, he's redefining masculinity in terms of submission to Christ.
Absolutely.
And so I like that because I think we're used to angry protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, we want The Rock to like kill somebody.
Skyscraper.
Right.
Ugh.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, don't. No.
Or we want somebody to like have somebody, you know, like taken. We want somebody to get revenge or like go get their daughter back. Or it's kind of like this fantasy that I think has been nurtured by cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And we get with Rogers, we have this totally different option. Like, that's how I kind of felt.
That's
how
I felt.
I have an option.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
I'm like, oh.
But you're the one proclaiming this dark side of him, and that's exactly what I felt. It's like, so, I mean, I get what you're saying about, like, there's some, a little bit of psychology there that might be, that they were alluding to, like, you know, how he literally is Daniel Tiger, and how that's how he expresses himself, which definitely could be some repression.
He's aware of it.
Yeah.
And then talking about his woundedness, they talk about, like, hey, Fat Freddy, and, like, that he was mocked as a kid. And I think that's... there's that woundedness is real, but I think he gives us different options. I do think that there's something like, well, is there a middle ground? Like, is there a place where, and I'm sure he found it. We just didn't, that's not part of his public image. Is there a place for Mr. Rogers to be upset about something?
Yeah. It didn't seem like there was, or it didn't seem like his, according to his kids or whatever, that there was no dark, like behind closed doors, he flipped out that one night, right? Unless they're holding that all back. It seemed like who he was on the show is who he was. That's what his wife said. So yeah.
Yeah. The film addresses that saying, like, no, maybe he just is this way and everything's cool.
Exactly.
Maybe. But, or maybe he's incredibly repressed.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who am I?
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely know, like, I haven't met somebody like that.
Exactly. So either he was an extremely one-of-a-kind special human being, or maybe there was, and he was. I think it's, he was.
Oh, I'd say that.
Yeah. But one thing that's interesting, kind of when we, speaking of the dark side, is how we can't handle it, right? That's kind of the tension you're getting at, right? And we see that in the movie when there were all these parodies of Mr. Rogers, you know, and it's kind of hard to watch because you have this... this pure guy that sort of embodies love everywhere he goes. And then you have, you know, Mad TV and SNL that just kind of want to drag him down to us, you know, that Jim Carrey sketch. Maybe he like beats people up in video stores, you know, and it's like kind of painful to watch because I know it's probably funny at the time, but compared to what we've seen up until that point in the movie, it's like, you're just trying to make him like you. And maybe he wasn't, like, just because you can't handle it. Right.
Yeah. So, but I think that like the choice that you're forced to make by the documentary is, well, this is an alternative mode of living. Right?
Yes. Yes.
And either I'm capable or I'm not capable. And most of us come out going, I ain't capable of this. Right.
Yeah.
So at that point you're like, well, screw this. I'm not going to be capable of this.
Mm-hmm.
The other, and then the other response that I felt was, this man is not expressing his emotions, the full range of human emotion, at least publicly. Now, I'm okay with that. Public, private, that makes sense to me, right? Mm-hmm. But at some point, you go, you know, because I'm sure we don't, like, express our full range, even on the podcast. But the idea being, like, is this guy, is there something, like, is there, like, some other ground where you can be fully present, emotional, seeking Christ, being able to express your pain and your suffering and your frustration and all those things? I'm not healthy in that way at all. Mm-hmm. I would like to be, but like, I don't, Roger is so far away from who I am
Yeah.
that it's really hard for me to like look at him as like, oh, he's an inspiring, could be like, I could be like him, because I'm so stunted compared
mm-hmm.
to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Totally.
And so like my other options are like, well, I can never be that. What a great saint.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, that's like, that doesn't really lead me to Christ really.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I understand. I get what you're saying. Like a part of me is like, well, is that what it means to be the church? Do we all have access to it in the sense that we believe that we have the Holy Spirit? We have access to the Holy Spirit every day. And was he walking in that kind of that divine flow in a way that most of us aren't? But then the flip side of that is, well, maybe he wasn't being entirely healthy as a human being, and maybe we're putting up a standard that we can't live up to because it wasn't the full range of human emotion. I get that. That's
so the movie makes clear that we ain't healthy, right?
Yeah, yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Like we're not healthy culturally. We're not healthy because he gets to the media issues, right? It's mm-hmm. like, this is really telling us, well, our culture is sick. Mm-hmm. He's more well than we are. And I would go, yes, absolutely. But it's not necessarily like, I wouldn't necessarily say that this is the full, maybe he's living the fullness of life. I don't know. I mean, obviously not now, but the idea mm-hmm. being like, maybe he lived this life that we could all live into.
Yeah.
I get nervous about having, making him into a more like taking his moralism or making him a moralistic figure and then putting him on a pedestal and making him unachievable.
Sure.
And I think this film does that to a degree, to where because if somebody's unachievable and doesn't have flaws, it's really hard to relate to them. And so it's a lot easier to like put them on the pedestal and say, I'm not like this person, and I don't have flaws, and I do have flaws, and I can't ever live into this. So like, that's, I guess, my.
So what does it mean to follow Jesus? I mean, I know Mr. Rogers isn't Jesus, but I mean, isn't that what right. we do every day, is that Jesus is the standard that we can never be, but he's the goal, right?
Right. So I think of like Dallas Willard, I think it's Spirit of Disciplines, or I can't remember which book it is, but Dallas Willard talks about the verse in what, 1 John, be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
How we tend to like weasel our way out of that idea.
Right. It doesn't mean perfect, right? Yeah. We instantly...
Oh yeah, it doesn't. It must mean this. Oh yeah, okay. And then you like pretty soon it just becomes, and I read my Bible 5 minutes a day, and I throw a couple of prayers out, and you know, and that becomes like, and that, you know, not that that's a bad thing. That's great. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's for me is like really progress. If I can do that every day of the week, that's really good.
Absolutely.
But what I would say is, yeah, we have the tendency to kind of underestimate what it looks like to be a follower of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So I think that your point is well taken.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that's interesting is as the movie progresses into the latter half, we see this kind of Mr. Rogers coming up against some darker, crazier events as the world sort of turns, specifically 9/11. And it's fascinating to me how this kind of embodiment of love and kindness that he was starts to feel almost outdated, you know, when he got older and you're put against these images of like, you know, terrorists attacking the World Trade Center. And it's almost like we got to a point as a culture where, yeah, I love people, that's nice, but, you know, there's people blowing up buildings. And you kind of sense that tension in the world where, you know, they had that woman who wanted him to do a PSA or something for the world basically after 9/11, and it was like, this isn't working.
Yeah, the idea is like, yeah. Hey, what's the point of all this?
Yeah.
So it's like this true despair that he's coming to grips with at the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
This is so reformed. I love it. Whatever my actions are, good, you know, whatever mm-hmm. like good I have, it is just a drop.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the bucket, and it might have absolutely no consequence. God is truly, it's either we get delivered by God or we don't. So you begin to put that control there. Now, I think it's bringing him a great deal of despair because he's given, you know, 30 whatever years of his life
yep.
to trying to serve children and to make them feel loved and cared for. So yeah, I think there was that level of despair. What I thought was interesting is, so if you look at like these other figures that are Lincoln, right? Or King, let's say King, right? Because he's a contemporary Rogers.
Totally.
A minister has some similar theology mm-hmm. even. And so I look at King, and King's also wanting to engage culture for change, but it's like a different, it's like that organizing model. King's much more flawed as far as, like, if you look at his, like, his moral, you know, credentials or whatever, you know, he has had affairs and all. And a lot of them were set up by the, one was set up by the FBI. I don't know all the details.
Yeah.
But the idea of, like, that King is, like, there's trade-offs. And he's being very sophisticated in how he deals with power. Mm-hmm. Roger is coming from an elite, wealthy, white position of power.
Yeah.
And then he brings his gentleness from that perspective, which, you know, it makes sense. Like, that he's probably pretty healed. He's probably well healed. Right.
Uh-huh.
And able to offer that. But I'd say, like, a lot of folks are more like King, or like, I can't watch this anymore.
Mm-hmm. You know? Right. Yeah.
And I'm going to do something. And I'm going to inspire others to do something, and might look at the exercise of their faith in a more political way, or mm-hmm. more like the activate way you're talking about.
Yeah.
Which is being, like, I think about the Midwest, being nice doesn't solve everything. Right?
Yes.
And I think that there is something, the upper Midwest is like big believers in be nice.
Uh-huh.
And I think Mr. Rogers is like, be nice. And I think there is the image of God on people is great.
Yeah.
That's like, it's so critical. And I pray for that, like, a lot of days, because I struggle with that.
Yeah.
I'm very hardened. And I try to pray for that a lot of times. But I also think, like, if we take the gospel, the fullness of the gospel and all the ramifications of the gospel, and reduce it to niceness, mm-hmm. then, yeah, there's trouble, because A, we can't be nice all the time. Right.
Right.
Maybe Rogers can. But also, I think it denies the pain of the world.
Yeah.
And it denies that people are, it becomes disembodied.
You know, I was, Sacha Baron Cohen, you know who that is?
Yeah, Borat. Sure.
He has a new show out on Showtime called Who is America? And it's kind of the same thing, where he's doing different characters and trying to prank people. But I heard some guy talking about Borat the other day, and he was saying, back then, what he was preying on was our culture of niceness, right? So Borat was this foreigner stumbling around doing horrible things, but people, like, participated and ignored the horrible part because they just wanted to be nice to this man who was a foreigner, right? So he would get them to join in singing, like, throw the Jew down the well, you know, because they were just trying to be nice. But I mean, like, that's what you're saying, is that in our pursuit of being nice at all costs, we can actually ignore injustice right in front of us and even be participants of it. I mean, I think that's what...
Although he's doing what Errol Morris is doing, but just on a comedy way. Huh? He's pointing out the bizarre values of the culture.
Yeah.
And racism and misogyny, and like, and he's doing that in a, and I'm not like a big fan of that film. I think it's okay.
Right.
But I think he's doing that in a creative way, that he allows people to tell their own story to a certain degree, and
gets out of the way and lets them hang themselves.
Yeah,
right.
Basically.
Right. Yeah. But the point well taken is that, you know, there is a, we need both. We need a Mr. Rogers to come into that congressional hearing and be this soft-spoken, gentle person to that cranky congressman, right? And get the funding for PBS. And we need Martin Luther King Jr. to get out there and be, in some ways, stronger than Mr. Rogers could be, or more forceful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yep.
And both are valid. And putting one on a pedestal and saying, that's it. That's the full range of humanity right there. Yeah.
So you and I are like, we're always talking about, I mean, I think Dan too. It's like the same, we say have the same argument every week.
Uh-huh.
But the idea of, like, where does this theology come from and where has it gone? Because I see this and as critical. So it's like that we're deeply engaged in culture for, you know, in service to the kingdom of God. And so, like, I know we talk about, well, no, so I look at King and I look at Rogers as both doing that.
Yes.
And so they're not resident aliens. They're residents, you know, of Earth,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and yeah, some of you theology types will know I'm like throwing dynamite sticks at Willimon.
Well, this is the argument.
Howard Voss.
Right. Howard Voss. Yeah. That's the argument we get into every now and then, is like, how engaged should we be in the world? Because the kind of the rising tide argument nowadays with Howard Voss and stuff is, we just need to be the church and let politics be politics. Don't get all involved in that stuff. Just be the church. And I'm like, politics affects like millions of people's lives. How can you love your neighbor and not be involved in that? But So it's just, it's kind of two different ways of seeing the world, and there's good arguments on both sides. Yeah.
So yeah. So but I always think it's interesting. Like, so the these guys come out of that tradition,
mm-hmm.
and so we see when the church, and it might just be that there were more qualified people that were in mainline church at that point. I mean, because you're talking about the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
But I wonder, like, is there, have we lost some theology there? I'm not just blaming it. I'm not like pointing just to Howard Voss and Willimon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they're just, they're giving us a different viewpoint that's from a different tradition. But I'm wondering, like, even like within the reform circles, like, have we lost some of this tradition? Like, where we're deeply engaging culture? We're like, oh no, this is just cultural assimilation. No, Mr. Rogers is not just cultural assimilation. He's prophetic.
That's
and
right.
So different.
That's right.
But some people at that point would be like, oh, he's, how can he be ordained as a children's, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So to me, I think that we may be missing something. And hopefully, like, we're doing a podcast. We're no Mr. Rogers.
No.
Clearly not, like, king. But what I would say is, like, do we want to engage? How are we engaging culture matters.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole idea of what does it mean to be countercultural? You know, like, there's that verse about not conforming to the world, right? And kind of conservatives have sort of ruined it as, like, don't watch Game of Thrones. But it's like, it's not, I think there's so much deeper than that. It's a way of being countercultural every day in the sense that, you know, we're the church, in the sense that we're bringing that sense of peace while everyone is frantic and running around. We're kind of supposed to be the harbingers of peace in the storm. And like, when it's popular to say, when someone asks, how are you, to say busy, because that makes you feel like valuable and worth something, you know, we can be the ones that say, I didn't do anything today, and that's okay. And so it's kind of, being countercultural to me is more like slowing down, putting down the phone.
So I think there's elements that he has of mysticism.
Yes,
so
that's
it. So he's like a monastic.
Yep.
And so he has you think about it, like, they give us his routine. He wakes up. He swims a mile a day.
Yes. He weighs the same every day.
He weighs himself. I mean, it's just like, you know, this is why people think he's a serial killer. But in any case, he weighs himself every day. Really? I'm sure he does scripture study, all this other stuff.
Yep.
But he has this routine that's almost like the hours, right?
Yes.
So he's monastic in the way he looks at existence. He's like, it's the same routine every day. And then he draws on this like deep mysticism that that we have within our tradition. And then, and it's in other traditions too, but within the Christian tradition. And then, but he also is pulling like a deep theology and a robust sense of how does the church engage culture?
Yes.
And it's not just Mr. Rogers' denomination is supporting him. And he's engaging. He's a Republican that works for PBS, right? And you're like, what? And I think that you're like, in the kingdom, you see those things that seem like contradictions that maybe wouldn't be.
Yep.
Yep.
And what's undeniable is how many people he influenced. The interviews in the movie are just incredible, especially the guy who played Officer Clemens back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, it's so moving how that whole, going back to how countercultural it was when Mr. Rogers had him stick his feet in the same pool, you know, with him at a time when, you know, people were kicking black people out of pool with like chemicals, you know, because in the heart of segregation. But just how Mr. Rogers became a surrogate father to this man who was gay and had to kind of hide it back in then. But eventually that came out and Fred accepted him for who he was. And just, he breaks down into tears and it's just really moving. And he had that kind of impact on everybody.
I thought it was so anachronistic how some of the reviewers treated that, which I was like, it's like the 60s, dude.
What do you mean? What did they say?
Like, so basically some of the reviewers are like, oh, but he, and I, you know, my sense is like somebody that didn't actually live during that time.
Yeah.
Oh, he totally forced this guy to remain closeted and that and that. And I was like, dude, it's the 60s.
Yeah, right.
And he's not trying to, I think he knows he's gay. I think the idea is like, they will not, like, he would lose his job.
Yeah, right.
And it would be bad for the show and all those other things. And it's not like there's a cultural condition for that to exist even.
Yeah.
Right?
There's no cat, yeah.
So you're like basically not looking at context at all. And so I was like, well, you look at Roger's like, well, I think he did, for the context, he probably did the best he could.
Mm-hmm. And it clearly touched him and changed him.
He felt loved.
Yeah, exactly. And then they close the film in such a powerful way by asking kind of every interviewer to think about, well, Roger said this at a commencement ceremony, but to think about one person that sort of shaped your life and turned you into the person you are today. And it's just incredible to see every single person that's interviewed in the movie kind of have that moment where, and they're all kind of basically reduced to tears. And I started tearing up because, like, for a moment, it's just, we share in our humanity and we're just people and we just need each other. And it's like all the walls of division, just for a brief moment, don't mean anything. And that's the power of mysticism, like you said, that can bring us to that point for a moment where we just love each other. And I just thought it was such a beautiful way to the end of the movie. And when the credits rolled, I just kind of like, I just was crying because the world is so screwed up. And it's just, he was this beacon of light, and maybe it was repression, but all the same, it just was, is so inspiring to, he's kind of represented to me the best of what we can be. And I thought it was beautiful. So one of Fred's last words before he died was a question to his wife where he asked, am I a sheep? You know, referencing Jesus's parable of the sheep and the goats. I thought it was just a stunning question because what we've seen until that point is like almost this nearly perfect guy. And on his deathbed, he's wondering if he's even going to make it to heaven, right? It just reminded me that truly humble people don't know they're humble.
I think so. It's also part of our pure, our like, it's our like neurotic Puritan heritage too.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So like that we were always questioning our salvation.
Yeah.
I think is part of it, which is so funny because he's not like questioning everyone else's salvation.
No,
like,
right.
Yeah. It seems like that.
He's not an in and out kind of guy, right?
Yeah. Those type of folks tend to, you know, those are the people that like are protesting outside of his funeral, right? Oh,
Westboro Baptist. Yeah.
They're questioning everyone's salvation.
Right.
He doesn't do that, but he is introspective and he is questioning. He's like, how did I, you know, did I do it right? And I like that that's there because it does show self-doubt. I think he needs that. You need that to round him out. So I'd say that portrays some emotion. And then I also like the duet between the woman in the land of make-believe and Daniel Tiger, mm-hmm. about Daniel Tiger feeling like he's garbage. And she's like, you're not. And those two songs would inhabit each one of us.
That's right.
So that we have those two narratives that are at war inside of us.
And they mentioned in the movie that Daniel Tiger was probably the closest to what Fred Rogers was as a person, like how he felt inside. So yeah. When he was singing that duet, it was kind of like his own personal ache.
I feel that way. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah.
There, and to me, there are those two songs inside of us. Mm-hmm. And one song is saying, you're no good. You're not special. You're miserable. Mm-hmm. And the other song is saying, oh, you're beautiful. You're loved. Mm-hmm. Everything about you, I made you this way, you know.
But it's a duet because they keep going back and forth.
On each other. To me, that was like the moment of that movie where I was like, you know, teary eyed.
Yeah,
because I think that's somehow we got very in touch with, I think, reality.
You are my friend.
Others I know are big and are wide. I'm very small and quite tiny.
Or shaking, or
most of the time I'm weak and I'm lying. Do you suppose that's a shame? I wonder if I'm
just fine as you are.
I'm not supposed to be scared, am I? Sometimes I cry and sometimes I shake, wondering, isn't it true that the strong never break? I'm not like anyone else. No, I'm not like anyone else.
So that's inside Fred too, and it's inside us.
Yeah,
and I don't know anybody that doesn't have that narrative unless they're a complete narcissist or a sociopath. That narrative, it exists in us. It's like this deep self-doubt with this also this deep affirmation that God brings us.
Beautiful. All right, Tim, final thoughts on Won't You Be My Neighbor and your letter grade. It's all you. Go.
I thought it was good. I don't think, you know, I think it's a good documentary. Mm-hmm. I think they did a good job of steering away from a canned format. And I thought the music was good. It was very compelling. What I saw in some of the reviews was there's nothing in the documentary you couldn't watch on YouTube.
Come on.
You know, they compiled it all.
It's a cheap shot.
Well, I know it is. But I think that was kind of cool. they're just using the archival footage. I don't think it's going to win like best documentary or anything like that.
Oh, I totally disagree. But no, okay. This is your moment. No, it's okay.
It's all right. It's our moment. We're here. I don't, because I don't think it is quite creative enough. I think it's emotionally compelling, but I don't think it's creative enough to do it.
All right. What's your Lundgren?
I would give it probably a B+.
Okay. Well, for me, Won't You Be My Neighbor is definitely the best movie that I have seen so far this year. I think it's an incredible film, a must-see in every way, and I think you should see it in the theater. I know that the theater has kind of become synonymous with action movies, but I think there's something that's deeper about the theater, that it's more about seeing a movie in community with other people, and I think this is the kind of a movie that you need to see with other people and let the emotions sort of coalesce in that room. I think it's powerful, and it was for me in the theater that I saw it with. It's like we were all feeling it together, and I thought it was beautiful. Now, is the movie perfect? I will say almost. The only criticism I had was that I felt the last act of the movie, where it gets a little darker, talking about 9/11, that whole thing, I think the pacing was thrown off a little bit. I felt like it started to feel a little rushed and a little bit kind of like steamrolling there, and it was like, because the pacing was so perfect in that first hour where you were just buoyed along every step of the way, and then it just started to feel like they were just kind of rushing to the end. So that's all I would say, but it's a small criticism. I am going to land on an A-, which is a big grade for me. I don't hand out a lot of those throughout the year, so it's an A-, and it is still the best movie I've seen this year, and we'll see what tops it, but that's where I'm at right now. I think it will win best documentary for sure.
I don't.
Okay.
But that's okay. We can disagree.
We can disagree. Well, there you have it, man. That's Won't You Be My Neighbor, and that's our show for today. Hey, if you have not headed over to Apple Podcasts and given us a 5-star rating and review, this is your moment. Right now, you can do it. I want to give a shout out to a listener who did just that for us. His name is Space Manatee. Great username. And he left us 5 stars and wrote this review, Tim, and I quote, "Yay, good stuff and stuff." That's all it takes.
Well, that's what we bring every time, stuff.
Stuff, we bring
and
stuff.
And sometimes we'll add extra stuff to the stuff.
Yep, 2 stuffs. How long do you think it took him to write that? Maybe 20 seconds? In that small amount of time that he took to write that beautiful review for us, that widens the net single-handedly for other people to discover the show. That's literally all it takes, a 5-star rating and a review like that that takes you no more than 20 seconds. That's what you can do for us. It's the best gift you can give us. Please do that.
Other space manatees out there.
Other space manatees, we need you. And
one
thank
out
you.
Of one space manatees.
And thank you to Space Manatee for listening. We really appreciate it. So we will be back next month. No idea what we're doing yet, but there are some interesting movies working their way down the pike, so we're going to find something good.
What are they?
We'll be back. Well, I'm interested in the new Gus Van Sant movie with Jonah Hill. Remember that one that you saw the trailer for with Joaquin Phoenix? He's in a wheelchair. That looks interesting to me.
You're so independent this summer.
Yeah, I know. There's this movie with Arnie Hammer called Sorry to Bother You that's supposed to be really good. So there's a lot of interesting films that I want to check out. Oh, you know what else has been getting a lot of buzz lately is this movie called Eighth Grade. I've read 2 reviews in Time Magazine, and it is supposed to be incredible. I know it's rated R, but it's about an eighth grader.
So if you're in eighth grade, you're not even allowed to see this flick.
I had to look at that rating twice. I'm like, really? It's called eighth? Yeah. It's about an eighth grader, but
it's
apparently
called, like, 11th
grade. It's real. So anyway, we're going to pick one of those, and we'll be back next month. And until then, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.